This is Take Care from WRVO Public Media. Thanks for joining us for this conversation on health and wellness. I'm Catherine Loper.
And I'm Jason Smith. Healthcare has been a major talking point this year, not just in the upcoming presidential election, but also among the general public.
We're hearing more about the true cost of health, the literal cost, like emergency room visits, prescription medications, or your health insurance premiums, but also the less obvious costs incurred by family members trying to take care of a loved one or trying to find cheaper alternatives to life-saving care.
And with entire news series and specials on surprise medical bills and outrageous prices for typical procedures, some of which you've heard on NPR, it's hard to ignore the issue any longer.
That's why we've reached out to doctors, reporters, and others in the field to try to understand the true cost of health. We'll examine that, plus the state of healthcare today, one doctor's thoughts on fixing the system, end-of-life care, and the latest data on healthcare expenses.
Now, if there's a lot of poor folks on the other side of town, you can probably find enough business to get by.
I figure to. I'll need a little eating money, though.
How much?
About $300.
Well, that's a whale of a lot of money, John. You got anything to offer for security?
17 years experience as a practicing physician. I've done pretty well.
Yeah? You're broke, ain't you?
I meant about keeping my patients alive. That's my business, you know.
To get the discussion started, we're joined by Olga Khazan, a staff writer at The Atlantic who primarily covers health, gender, and science. Olga, welcome to Take Care.
Thanks so much for having me.
Now, you wrote an article in The Atlantic a few months ago called Americans Are Going Bankrupt from Getting Sick. Millions of people are struggling with medical debt, and it's not just people who don't have insurance that are affected. We could probably spend this entire interview talking about this one question, but if you could sum it up for me, why is healthcare so expensive?
Healthcare is so expensive because essentially hospitals and emergency service providers like ambulances can kind of set their own price for the services they provide. And a lot of times a hospital is basically, the way one economist described it to me, it's just a box with a bunch of doctors in it, and the doctors don't necessarily take your insurance. So anytime you end up in the hospital, there's no guarantee that every person who comes in your room, touches your chart, does something, you know, removes a catheter, does whatever, is going to take your insurance. And that's where those high prices come in.
So who is most affected by medical debt? Is it low-income people without insurance, or is it pretty much everybody?
Really, honestly, I mean, I've been interviewing a lot of people who have been getting surprise medical bills in the tens of thousands of dollars, and it's really a wide swath of the population. Obviously, if you don't have health insurance, you're going to be hit pretty hard because just kind of everything is going to be considered out of network for you, and you're not going to get any kind of insurance discount on any of your bills. At the same time, hospitals might have like a charity care program for folks like that, or be able to work out some sort of deal with you if you're completely uninsured. In some ways, like, you could get like a special break if you're uninsured. But even people who have great insurance will get bills that are extremely high, surprise medical bills, because some of the providers were out of network that they had interacted with during their hospital stay.
Is this a problem that is really primarily only seen in the United States?
It is something that you mostly see in the U.S. because most other countries regulate. Either they regulate prices, so hospitals can't charge you just whatever they want. They have to charge you a set amount. Or the way they set up their insurance is that everyone is insured, so there's not really like this giant uninsured population of people who are just being charged the sticker price. Or they just have single payer where the doctors work for the federal government and they're paid a salary and it doesn't matter how many tests they run on you because they're going to get paid the same amount. So essentially, we have this kind of unique system, you know, that's set up employer-sponsored healthcare that really creates the situation that we have now with a lot of people getting these really high medical bills.
It's probably the million-dollar question here, but why is it this way in the United States and when the rest of the world does it almost completely different?
Yeah, I'm not the biggest historian of how we got where we are. I do know that at various points, the U.S. has considered having more of a single-payer style health care system, but various kind of interest groups have fought that, and really kind of the thing that they were able to work out was having a situation where hospitals are basically just businesses and everyone's covered by insurance, and then the main way that you get insurance is through work. And so we're obviously seeing some of the pitfalls of that system now, but that is the system that was created, you know, half a century ago, and we've sort of been stuck with it ever since.
Your article in The Atlantic that I mentioned at the beginning, it started talking about a woman who had a medical issue, and when someone called an ambulance, in the middle of what turned out to be a mini stroke that this woman was having, she was kind of trying to decide right there whether or not she could or should refuse an ambulance ride and decide which hospital she should be taken to. So what can people do if it is an emergency situation and they can't shop around, so to speak?
Yeah, I mean, there's not like a secret thing to do. So what happened with this woman, it was a really sad case. So her words started slurring. She wasn't making any sense. And she was rushed to the hospital. The bill that she got charged was $26,000, or actually a little bit more than that. It did get eventually written off because she was completely uninsured and unemployed. Like there was going to be no way for her to pay this bill, essentially. But there's not really a way to make sure that the ambulance that you're going to take is going to be covered by your insurance. There's not really a way to make sure that every doctor you see is going to be covered by your insurance. You can try if you're getting like an elective procedure. If you're getting like a planned surgery, you can call the hospital and ask if every doctor will be covered by the insurance that you have, but it's really hard to guarantee in emergency situations that you are going to be in the clear after you get out. And that's why several states and even Congress is now considering banning these kinds of surprise medical bills, just because it's really impossible for customers to be able to predict.
Yeah, and just like you just said, another thing that happens, these people will go to the hospital, they'll get a bill from the hospital, and while that one bill may be big, they may think that that's the only bill they're getting, but then more bills come, and it's often from different doctors that saw the patient or for different services they had. And so for people who get these large bills, sometimes by surprise, again, whether they have insurance or not, is there anything they can do if they call up the hospital and says, look, I just can't pay it? Is that it, or are they stuck, or what are the options there?
Yeah, so the options really, yeah, your best bet is going to be to call the hospitals and the individual doctors and try to negotiate. So this is where it's also a little unfair because it's kind of skewed toward people who have really great negotiation skills. So, you know, it's calling and asking, do you have a charity care program for the uninsured? Do you have financial assistance? Are you willing to charge me the amount you charge someone who has Medicare, which is typically a lower rate? So it's really trying to get the hospital to meet you in the middle and some of those other doctors that are billing you. That's the advice, but sometimes people who have just been in the hospital aren't really in a position to negotiate a high-stakes thing like that because they might still be really sick. So it is, unfortunately, still really unfair, and some people do go to get legal aid. They get consumer advocates to try to work with them, but it's all still based on what the person themselves is willing to do and how much time they're willing to spend on the phone and debating these things.
This may differ based on doctor or hospital or medical service, but is there any way to know sort of upfront about some of these charges? Would it help if a patient called for an ambulance and that patient was told, well, sure, we'll come get you, but we're going to charge you $1,800?
Possibly. I guess like if you're feeling well enough to like negotiate with the ambulance yourself, then you should probably just take an Uber or something. But it's really hard to know what different procedures are going to cost ahead of time. Hospitals don't make these things public. It's just really impossible to know and guesstimate how much you're going to be charged. I myself recently had surgery, and I'm a health reporter, and I had no idea how much it was going to cost, and it ended up costing almost $1,000, and I have health insurance. So yeah, it's a total roll of the dice.
For people who are facing these surprise bills, these extremely large medical bills, and they go into this debt, and part of your article referenced a study where the study said that 60% of people that declared bankruptcy said that a medical debt was part of the reason why. So when people are experiencing this medical debt, and they may call the hospital or their healthcare provider and say, is there anything you can do? I can't pay this bill. I have to assume there are occasions where the hospital says, no, there's nothing we can do. So what happens to these people then?
So eventually the bill will be put into collections. Then you'll have a collections agency coming after you, and they might be kind of more willing to negotiate because they're just trying to collect anything at all, and so that you might be able to negotiate with the collections agency. At the same time, you might not want a collections agency to be on the case because they can tend to call you really frequently, you know, send a lot of letters. Eventually, it could be a medical claim could be put on your credit report. Another thing I've been hearing about is some providers selling their unpaid bills to these companies called medical debt buyers, who basically just buy medical debt for pennies on the dollar and try to collect on it however much they can. So, like, they'll collect, like, maybe a third of the amount that's owed, and they're pretty satisfied because that's more than what they paid. But that's really kind of the last resort. But they're very willing to negotiate because they basically just want to make a little bit of profit on all that debt they bought. But yeah, it's really an incredible kind of underground economy dedicated to collecting on medical bills.
Healthcare is almost always at the forefront of politics these days in the United States. And as the Democratic candidates for president continue to talk about their proposals, what are some of the Democratic candidates saying or proposing as they're on the campaign trail as a way to try to fix our healthcare system?
A lot of what these kinds of stories spark is this desire for a total overhaul of the healthcare system. So then you start seeing candidates like Bernie Sanders or Elizabeth Warren proposing more of a single-payer type system where everyone basically has a version of Medicare, and you can go to any doctor, and you're basically treated like a Medicare patient, where just by being in this country, you're covered with health insurance. You don't have to deal with any of these crazy bills. You don't have to decide between Cigna or Aetna or what have you. And that has some challenges associated with it as well. Some people say that would be too expensive to do, that it would lead to long waits for certain types of doctors. This is like a very hotly contested area of health economics. There's a lot of white papers being written on both sides of that debate. Experiences like this and statistics like these are really what has sparked this interest in a total overhaul of the American medical system.
Well, thank you very much for joining us today.
Absolutely. Thanks so much for having me.
Olga Hazan is a staff writer at The Atlantic. Her work, including the piece that inspired this interview, Americans Are Going Bankrupt from Getting Sick, can be found at theatlantic.com.
That doctor, Dr. Humphrey, he's very expensive, I imagine. I've been figuring a few things out about the expense. I'll be all right. Louise Simpson and I intend to pay for everything, Ellen. Louise is responsible for this having happened to you, and you should let her pay the expenses.
I would rather pay my own bills, Victoria. I just don't want to be beholden to anyone.
Next, we ask what the state of healthcare is today and where it's headed. Presidential candidates aren't the only ones on the hook. Many Americans are asking, what's next? Dan Goldberg joined us from the offices of Politico. He's a healthcare reporter for Politico Pro, covering healthcare politics and policy in the U.S. Thanks for joining us today, Dan.
Thank you so much for having me.
So I'm going to start with the not small question of why is healthcare so expensive in some places like the U.S. and even certain areas?
Okay, I'm going to give you one of the simpler answers to that question. We pay our doctors and hospitals a lot more money than other countries do. That is, according to a lot of study that's been done, one of the driving factors of healthcare costs. A secondary factor, and this is where it starts to get a little more complicated, is how much we spend on drugs. But if you take those two together, you've really got a good idea of why healthcare in the United States is so expensive. It's what we pay. It's the prices for doctors and for hospitals and for administrators. That level is where the money is going.
Well, that's one of the simpler explanations I've ever heard, so thank you for that. Now, even though the U.S. does pay the most, I think it is, per capita on health, we don't have the number one health outcomes. Why that discrepancy?
No, not by far. In the United States, we're sort of middle of the pack, depending on how you want to be grading. That has a lot to do with socioeconomic factors. I'm oversimplifying, but only to a point. Your health outcomes have a lot to do with your income. And we have some very poor and very rural parts of the United States. It also has a lot to do with your race. We know that the life expectancy of white middle class or upper middle class people is a lot longer than black middle class people. Why that is very complicated and multi-generational. But now we're also starting to see the average lifespan in the United States decline, in part because of the opioid epidemic. We're seeing so-called deaths of despair, whether it's opioids or alcohol, especially in the middle part of the country, in the Midwest, in Appalachia, these areas that have traditionally been left behind either because the economies have suffered or because of other economic factors, you're starting to see a greater decrease in overall health, but even in the basic bench line of life expectancy. And so the United States being as big a country as it is, we have these pockets that do a lot worse than a lot of our, for example, European competitors or other Western developed countries. That's one big reason why you see such variability.
There are differences in health care costs and health insurance costs in different areas of the U.S. Does that go back to what you were talking about before with the cost of doctors and prescriptions, or are there other reasons too?
Sure. I mean, there are other reasons, but that is a big part of it. If you are in New York City, for example, the cost of healthcare is much higher than it is in Topeka. But by the same token, what plays into it is how rural you are. Costs of healthcare in Alaska are, even though it's a small, low population state, are very high because it's very remote. So there are a lot of factors that can contribute to the costs of healthcare. And obviously, it also is relative to the income of the population. So what seems expensive to people in Vail, Colorado, might not seem as expensive to people in the Upper West Side of Manhattan.
So because healthcare is so expensive in the U.S., we are always talking about ways to get more bang for our buck. So what are some of the ideas currently being bandied about?
One of the most popular ones are what are called value-based care. And essentially, federal and state governments are moving away from this idea that a doctor or a hospital would get paid for every service they provide you. So traditionally, you go to the doctor, they run three tests, they get paid three times. So there's an incentive for a doctor to run not only more tests, but the more expensive tests. And that's been determined to be probably not the best incentive structure. So what's now in vogue is what they call value-based care. They're going to pay a set fee for all the care you receive, and you would get more money if you keep the patient healthy. So there are bonuses or penalties for how a patient does. That's one model. Another model is the insurance company will determine that knee replacement, for example, will cost, let's just say, $10,000. And then the doctor and the hospital have an incentive to get all your care for that knee replacement, including any post-op or what have you, in that $10,000 range. And that's another way to sort of limit the amount of work being done on a patient. And then finally, there's a big movement toward preventive care. Can we keep people well before they get sick? And obviously the idea is if people don't need a hospital or a doctor, or if people can get a visit at home or a text message from a nurse instead of going to an emergency room, that would save the system a lot of money. And that's, you know, what I just said in 30 seconds is obviously a lot harder to do in practice, but that's where the system is trying to find some savings.
So health insurance is obviously a big part of the equation as far as the cost of healthcare goes, as you alluded to. Probably the biggest change in health insurance over the recent years has been the advent of Obamacare or the Affordable Care Act. So how do you think the ACA has helped or not helped healthcare overall?
It's a very good question. There's two big parts to the ACA. The first is what we typically think of purchasing private health care. And that has enabled millions of people to purchase health insurance with subsidies from the federal government. They are able to afford their premiums. There's also the Medicaid expansion, which is for people just over the poverty line, have been now qualified for Medicaid. And that's made a huge difference for millions of people who would never have been able to afford insurance before. So taken together, what the Affordable Care Act has unquestionably done is provided health insurance to millions of more Americans. Now, the flip side of that is that it did not do very much to control costs. So a lot of people may have insurance, but their deductibles may be $3,000, $4,000. And for a lot of people, that is well more than they are able to pay. Their premiums may be very high if they do not qualify for subsidies. So it's eating up more and more of their household income. So without really tackling costs, Obamacare has been able to provide people insurance, but not necessarily peace of mind.
And now the next step is we enter the 2020 election, and some of the biggest things that are being talked about or terms that are being used are universal health care and Medicare for all. These two terms mean a lot of different things to different people, but can you just briefly explain what the most common meanings of those terms are?
Sure. So the Democrats all want to provide health insurance at a more affordable price to more people. That's the aim. And the question among the varying candidates is how best to get there. So I think probably the simplest and most universal, for lack of a better word, is Bernie Sanders' plan, which is Medicare for all. And that would just be over 4 years. He takes the age of Medicare, which is right now 65, and slowly reduces it until it covers everyone. And you'd have your traditional Medicare, and it would act as basically a government health insurance plan and cover all your health care needs. And he would pay for that by raising taxes. His campaign promise is that what you spend now on health care for your family would just go to the federal government in form of increased taxes, and it would be a wash for most, and some would see less increase in their taxes than they're currently spending on health care. So that's sort of the far left end of the spectrum. Then you have a plan sort of like Kamala Harris, who has a bit longer of a transition period. She would take 10 years as opposed to Bernie's four, that still moves the country toward a Medicare for all-like system. So there'd be basic services would be covered by the government. But then you'd have private insurance to pick up some of the ancillary services or to fill in so that there are lower co-pays. And then sort of more to the, I guess, of the right of the Democratic Party is where Mayor Pete Buttigieg or Joe Biden are, and more of a public option, where you'd have the ability to buy into Medicare. You wouldn't necessarily automatically get it. You'd have to pay something for it, as opposed to raising taxes on everyone. So those are sort of the three basic ideas floating around the Democratic Party. Obviously, there are nuances within each, and there are varying levels of political reality associated with each. Those give you a pretty good idea of where the Democrats are right now.
And then Republicans talk a lot about more access to health care versus better or more health insurance. Do we have any idea of what voters or citizens are supporting at this point via polls or other methods? Or are there other ideas out there that are capturing the public's attention?
I'd caution your listeners to be skeptical of polls they see, because a lot of this stuff depends on how you ask the question. We learned a lot of that when polls were conducted about Obamacare, which Obamacare always polled terribly. The Affordable Care Act polled much better. So just even changing the name changed the response. And that's been true of something like Medicare for All. When you ask people about the idea of providing health insurance to everybody, it sounds great and it polls pretty well. When you ask people about increasing taxes on everybody to pay for health insurance, obviously it polls much less favorably. So the polling is a little bit all over the place at this point, and I'm cynical by nature probably, but particularly cynical when it comes to polling a complicated idea like Medicare for All or a public option.
So what about on the state level? When the Affordable Care Act came in, some states, you know, embraced the idea, some did not. Are there ideas or things going on the state level now to help lower the cost of health insurance or health care?
I think at the state level is where you're seeing a lot of that value-based care that I talked about earlier. New York, for example, has tried to, through its Medicaid program, which covers about a third of all the people in New York, really incentivize hospitals to think of new payment systems where they are sort of rewarded for keeping people healthy. And that has tried in some small way to shift the idea away from you're going to get paid the more you do. And some of the large hospital systems have responded and sort of re-examined how they think about providing care. You're also seeing, for example, in North Carolina, a similar focus. A lot of men and women from the Obama administration are now actually working in North Carolina for various either healthcare organizations or health insurers or some for the governor down there. And again, trying to implement this idea of moving away from this fee-for-service model. So I think that's probably where you're seeing a lot of innovation at the state level. In Georgia, for example, if you're looking at more conservative states, there are ideas being floated around for a high-risk pool, which essentially just means we take the sickest people in our population and insure them separately so that the healthy people can keep lower rates and will subsidize the very sick. That hasn't had great success in other states that have tried it, but there's a lot more knowledge and data on people now than there was 5 or 10 years ago. So there's some, I suppose, hope that it might work. But that's sort of where a conservative state is leaning.
So just to wrap this up, since you pay a lot more attention to this than most of us do, what are you most looking at, either as far as problems or solutions to this rising cost of health insurance and healthcare?
I'm most interested in sort of how, especially Democrats, obviously, because there's a primary now, how some of the national Democrats are thinking about paying for their plans. How do we talk to doctors and hospitals about the money they take in? When we started, I mentioned that one of the simpler ways to look at this is that the cost of what doctors and hospitals make is really a prime driver. But who can find a way to control those costs, to keep those costs from growing faster than inflation? Nobody's really been able to tackle that problem. And that's, I think, one of the most interesting challenges ahead for sort of controlling costs, is how do we control the literal price of healthcare?
Thanks again for joining us today, Dan.
Thanks so much for having me.
That was healthcare reporter Dan Goldberg joining us from the offices of Politico in Arlington, Virginia.
We're taking a short break here, but when we return, we'll get one doctor's take on fixing, not perfecting, the healthcare system. This is Take Care. Listening to Take Care, a health and wellness show from WRVO Public Media. I'm Jason Smith.
And I'm Catherine Loper. Thanks for staying with us. We're moving on now to addressing and fixing issues in our healthcare system with an assistant professor of pulmonary and critical care medicine at the University of Washington.
Dr. Vin Gupta joined us with his thoughts, some of which he details in a New York Times opinion piece titled Fix Our Healthcare System, Don't Try to Make It Perfect. Thanks for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having me.
Well, before we get into how we might be able to fix our healthcare system, I know you could probably spend an entire interview talking about this, but can you talk a little bit about why our healthcare system is broken?
That's a difficult question to answer in just a few minutes. But what I'd like to focus on in what is a really complicated question is quality of care. We talk a lot about coverage. Our political debate is so focused on how many people are covered, how many people are uninsured, how can we best fix that equation. We don't talk enough about quality of care and what we can actually do to improve the patient experience and, in doing so, hopefully minimize the number of times they need to come, for example, and see me in pulmonary clinic. How do we actually do that? We'll talk about quality as well. Our political candidates will talk about that. What does it mean? And I think the lack of nuance when it comes to the quality debate in our healthcare system is problematic, and to me is an area that we can actually readily improve on right now, given existing innovations, given the fact that these issues really are not partisan issues. Whether you're a Democrat or Republican, improving quality of healthcare in the United States has nothing to do with philosophies on the role of government in healthcare, like coverage does. To me, I think that's the big issue that could be remedied more quickly and is what I focus on a lot in my day job.
I'm wondering how it is we actually got to this point, because you've written that some of the policies that are being pushed by some of the Democratic presidential candidates now and by former President Obama with Obamacare, they're similar to policies that were pushed by President Nixon back in the 1970s. So can you talk a little bit about how President Nixon tried to reform healthcare?
It's a great question. I think it's something that we don't talk enough about is how much our politics has shifted in just 40 years, such that President Nixon advanced what we now call Nixon Care, which was a liberal version of the Affordable Care Act, i.e. Obamacare. By that, I mean, for example, there's a lot of pushback on Medicaid expansion at the state level. 13 states still have not agreed to expand Medicaid, even though it's largely a federally funded program to the tune of 90%. So a lot of states are saying no to federal money, to federal taxpayer money. Under Nixon Care, there was no yes or no. You took the money, it was 100% federally subsidized. That's a drastic difference in 40 years between what a conservative president was trying to push forward versus what a centrist Democrat ultimately was able to pass through both houses of Congress and then obviously through the executive. In 40 years, we saw a shift in just the nature of our politics, what centrism in healthcare really means. And I think it means something very different today than it did during the era of President Nixon, which is to say that we're never going to reconcile this debate on coverage, I think, in my lifetime. I'd venture a guess that in anyone who is listening to this in your lifetime, we're not going to reconcile the coverage debate. We're just going to keep having it. And so we have to think about different ways to tackle our healthcare crisis, and one of which is quality.
One of the things that you've written a bit about is politicians should stop striving for perfection and just go for small changes. Why do you think it is that politicians, whether it's Congress or presidential candidates, why is perfection the goal rather than these small incremental changes that can add up to big healthcare reform?
You've nailed the crisis of our democracy, or at least our communication on healthcare, with that question. And I'm going to start touching on things that are not directly in my wheelhouse here, but in my view, our politics when it comes to healthcare and more broadly has devolved into how do you get the most likes on Twitter? How do you get the most donors to give you a few dollars on an online platform? Which is to say, how can you be provocative versus how can you be substantive? In my view, candidates that are pushing forward policies that talk about Medicare for all, you know, listen, I have a military background. I'm a public health physician. There is nobody who deals with the realities of unaffordable healthcare coverage for patients, lack of access, more than I do. I see the realities of that day to day. It's not just a political talking point. But if you tell me we have a slate of Democratic candidates who are running on Medicare for All, you know, the vast majority, they're pushing forward a policy proposal that maybe has 100 votes in the House. The Democratic Party controls the House. And we're saying we're going to line up, or they're saying they're going to line up for a proposal that maybe is getting 100 votes, if that. So in effect, they're saying we're okay with an action, that in January of 2021, we are going to tolerate an action if that means we get to advocate on a platform that meets some other end goal that is not change. And so that's why I value candidates and people who put forward substantive, pragmatic platforms that have a chance of passing both houses of Congress, that have a chance of bringing about incremental change, even if that's fundamentally not sexy or not as provocative on our social media platforms.
In your opinion, and when I ask your opinion of this as a doctor, and I don't want you to endorse any of the candidates, but in your view, do any of the Democratic candidates out there right now have a proposal that is seen by you and the medical community as something that would be acceptable and has a chance of passing in a Democratic-led House?
I think former Vice President Joe Biden has been a leader on wanting to improve on what's already been great progress. So the Affordable Care Act, I think, whether you're a Republican or a centrist Democrat, whether you're progressive left or far right, hopefully we can just look at the facts. I know it's hard to do that in this current climate, but hopefully we can look at the facts of the Affordable Care Act and say broadly that there has been incremental improvement. 27 million people have health insurance that previously didn't prior to 2010. Premiums in some cases have come down. Obviously, there are challenges. It's not a perfect law. We need improvement. I think the former VP and his policies that are focused on improving the Affordable Care Act and bringing about incremental change when it comes to making or broadening access to Medicare, expanding Medicaid to states that have yet to do so premium-free, that's a very progressive platform, and I think it's touching the boundaries of what is probably unlikely to pass both houses of Congress, but it's also the most centrist platform that any of the Democratic candidates have put forward. And so all of us in the medical community, at least my colleagues, we want change that is likely to pass, and I think the former VP is most proximal to that space of promise, potential, but pragmatism.
You talked about quality of care, and you've talked about what some of the Democratic presidential candidates are proposing in terms of helping to fix our healthcare system. But I'd like to know, what are some of the things that you think can and should be done to bring down the cost of healthcare in the United States? It's tens of trillions of dollars that's been spent on healthcare, but you think it could be done better. What are some of the ways that you think that healthcare could be done with less money?
It's a great question. It's something that does not, especially in the United States, when there's a very complicated mix of stakeholders in our healthcare system, so much so that people always ask me, well, why can't we do what Switzerland or what Canada does? And transposing the business side of healthcare that is unique to the Canadians or the Swiss to the United States is impossible. What they're doing, we cannot necessarily do one-to-one. So we can't just transpose their system to ours. So how do we work within the realities that exist right now, recognizing that we have a political system that's in crisis, that there are structural challenges that minimize our ability to bring about revolution? I'd like to focus on three areas, and I've written about this recently, one of which is, why are we not, unlike our peer countries, i.e. the United Kingdom, why are we not leaders in fostering innovation in healthcare delivery? And by that, I mean, so many innovations are happening as we speak, as developed by our American technology companies in the space of digital health. And whether that means telemedicine delivery and reimbursing providers that use telemedicine type interventions to make it easier for patients to access subspecialty care, whether that's how do we actually use the technology that's already in our hands. I won't endorse a specific product, but for example, I wear the Apple Watch, or if you wear a different type of smart device that monitors your physical activity, how do we actually utilize that really nuanced information that provides data points over months, if not years, to improve the quality of care of a patient with a pre-existing condition? Right now, we have no idea how to actually operationalize and utilize that information, and that is an opportunity lost. The United Kingdom has already developed a 6-point plan that's being put into place by the NHS, but has been discussed at very high levels of parliament. We don't have any of those debates here in the United States, much less any candidate talking about digital health, which has the potential to revolutionize how we think about healthcare, how we interface with our physician. And then lastly, I'll say that there are a lot of different ways that people are thinking about innovations in primary healthcare. Direct primary care is an example of trying to actually root out the middleman, which is the insurance company, and just having clients interact with their physicians, pay a set fee, get a basket of services, and make that interaction simpler and frankly more affordable. And studies have shown that these innovative models of primary care delivery can improve patients' quality of life and decrease attendant costs. So we are not having the debates that we should be having in Congress amongst our elected leaders. We keep recycling the same talking points on coverage, and we're not talking about innovation, which America should be a leader on, because all that innovation is primarily happening here. We're not talking about different ways to deliver care at the primary care level. And I will say one last thing. End-of-life care, 30% of Medicare costs occur at the end of life, in the last 3 weeks of life. We talk a lot more now about end-of-life planning, end-of-life care, broadening access to palliative care services and what have you. There's a difference between where our rhetoric is and where our intentions are and what is actual reality. Most places that have palliative care services, that intervention doesn't happen until it's too late. Almost 40% of American hospitals still lack palliative care services. It's a huge opportunity missed to have people have the type of end-of-life care and planning that they really want, so that they don't necessarily have to die in an ICU or in a hospital, but surrounded by family at home.
You've already mentioned when we won't see this type of healthcare reform in our country, but realistically speaking, what do you think it is going to take before we have major healthcare reform in the United States?
The way we are going right now in our current debate and our current crisis, I think what it's going to take is structural political reform, which has perhaps nothing directly to do with actually the healthcare crisis, but I think we as a country need to think about the reason why we can't have platforms in our healthcare system similar to what the Canadians or what the Swiss do is because we have structural obstacles in our political system that prevent our elected leaders from taking bold, courageous stances on things like Medicare for All. I wish we had more than 100 votes in the House for something like Medicare for All, because I actually think it would ultimately end up saving costs and broadening access to care for all of our patients. We just don't have the incentives for our elected leaders to take those types of courageous stances right now. So money out of politics, term limits, full structural reform of our political system so that we actually get ideas and merit permeating our elected leaders, not lobbying and vested interests.
Thank you very much for your time today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Dr. Vin Gupta is an assistant professor of pulmonary and critical care medicine at the University of Washington.
We know that healthcare is expensive, and a big part of that cost is dying. 10% of all healthcare spending in this country is spent on end-of-life care. Ellen Abbott reports.
In 2018, Americans spent $3.65 trillion on healthcare. $3.65 billion of it went for end-of-life care. Upstate Medical University professor Greg Eastwood says that's a lot of money.
The real question that we should ask, and we should ask it of not only the last year of life, but of everything we spend money on in terms of health care, are we getting our money's worth? What are we spending it on? Is it of value to us?
Eastwood, a professor of bioethics, humanities, and medicine at Upstate, has written a book, Finishing Our Story, Preparing for the End of Life, that looks at the planning for death. Eastwood says money is often a secondary consideration for a family dealing with the imminent death of a loved one.
I would say the primary consideration are the wishes of the patient. And the wishes of the patient very often are expressed by the family because the patient can't speak.
But things get more complicated in this day and age, according to Eastwood, because of the evolution of medicine.
We did not have the ability to intubate people and put them on a ventilator, give them potent drugs to stimulate their heart and keep their blood pressure going and so on. And what happens now is that so often people come into hospital and they receive the, what I call the gadgetry, and then they get into an almost irreversible position of being very sick, usually no longer able to conduct their own affairs, to make decisions for themselves, so someone else has to. And then the question is, how long are we going to do this?
Eastwood says because of the premium this culture puts on the wishes of a dying person, the best way to deal with it is to talk about it early on. He urges people to legally appoint someone to represent their wishes at the end of life. In New York State, for example, that means appointing a healthcare proxy.
Having discussions when you're well, and maybe when you're 25 years old. certainly when you're in midlife, having discussions with someone you trust, often it's a spouse, but may not be, about what your values are. What does quality of life mean to you? And envisioning several scenarios where maybe you would say, I don't want to live longer like this.
Those discussions could also include thoughts on hospice or palliative care. Eastwood says those less expensive options are on the table more and more now.
The trend had been because of all the machinery and the gadgetry and the care that's available is mostly in hospitals. So that's why people predominantly died there. And then there's this realization that, well, maybe that's not the best place to die. And so there's a movement now to try to orchestrate things and try to get people who are dying to be at home.
But that initial question of whether end-of-life care is worth it may never be answered.
If we can save, let's say, several billion dollars at the end of life, can we then apply that to vaccinations for kids or better health care for people who don't have good health care? You know, it's a fundamental argument that gets repeated a lot, but unfortunately not resolved.
I'm Ellen Abbott for Take Care.
Part of understanding the cost of health is knowing the facts and figures and how they've changed over time. Two organizations have developed a partnership in this endeavor.
They're monitoring how well the U.S. healthcare system is performing in terms of quality and cost. Joining us with more about the Peterson-Kaiser Health System Tracker is Matthew Ray.
What we try to do is provide sort of nonpartisan, neutral, objective information on how the health system is performing in sort of a variety of different ways. Importantly, issues around how is the health system delivering quality? Is the health system providing value, providing care at reasonable prices? So we try to provide the sort of summary statistics and sort of analysis that helps people come to conclusions about those things.
Ray is associate director for the Program on the Healthcare Marketplace at the Kaiser Family Foundation. He's also a co-author of a recent study that examined the rise in premium contributions and cost sharing for families that have insurance, specifically large employer coverage.
Roughly half of Americans get their health insurance through their employer, and usually that cost is shared in some way, with the employer paying a portion through a premium contribution, and then the workers also pay in two ways. They both pay monthly to their paycheck. Some amount is deducted to pay for their coverage, and they pay when they use services. So looking at those two things together, the average family is chipping in about $8,000 towards their health insurance every year, both in their premium contribution and in cost sharing, such as deductibles. Those values are going up over time and going up much faster than what workers are seeing in wage increases. So over the last decade, workers are chipping in about 67% more in either premium contributions or cost sharing, such as deductibles and copays.
Now, if you're generally a very positive person or maybe a little naive, this may not come as much of a surprise to you. Everything costs more over time thanks to inflation. The cost of a new 1994 Toyota Corolla was around $13,000. Today, that number's closer to $20,000.
The problem here is that inflation is not keeping up with the cost of healthcare.
What we as workers are spending on health insurance has gone up probably about twice as fast as workers' wages. Workers' wages have increased about 26%. The burden continues to be shared by both workers and employers. Employers are chipping in more for health insurance year after year. On average, the worker contributes about a third of the total cost of the premium, which is roughly similar to what it was a decade ago. But workers are still paying more because they're paying more in cost sharing, such as deductibles and copays.
But the fact that insurance costs continue to rise hasn't stopped employers from offering insurance, according to Ray.
Now, why the prices are going up is the cost of healthcare is just more and more expensive every year.
And these continuously rising costs affect employees.
Some plans continue to offer relatively generous benefits, and other workers may face benefits which are much less generous. Those employers may be much less able to sort of accommodate rising prices. So affordability remains like a huge challenge for even those receiving employer coverage or a plan from their employer, especially for low-wage workers and workers who don't have sort of the financial assets or income to make what I think is considerably high levels of cost sharing and premium contributions at roughly $8,000 a year.
One way this is felt among households, Ray says, is in the form of rising deductibles.
So more and more of our out-of-pocket spending happens in the form of deductibles, which can also be like a big number that employees have to meet before the plan covers most services. So now the average deductible for someone enrolled in employer coverage is over $1,500 and has sort of drastically increased over the last 10 years.
And that will affect how people make decisions, important decisions, like whether or not to seek care at all.
And this is the challenge the healthcare industry faces today. How to fix the problem is much less clear.
Many of the ways that we know to reduce the cost of the health insurance plan have sort of other undesirable effects. So increasing cost sharing for workers would decrease the cost of premiums, but that puts more burden on those who get sick or need to use services. Reducing the size of provider networks and meaning that health plans are skimpier and the benefits they covered. But all these things potentially expose people to other financial risks. So it's a challenge to think about how we can continue to provide sort of a generous health benefits and protect people from all these financial risks while reducing the overall cost of premiums.
Regardless, the Peterson-Kaiser Health System Tracker will continue to provide information about the cost of health. Their annual employer health benefits survey is out now. Find more at healthsystemtracker.org.
If you have comments, questions, or suggestions about today's show or anything else, get in touch with us. Email takecare@wrvo.org or find us on social media. This episode and others are available online at wrvo.org and on iTunes.
Take Care is a health and wellness show produced by WRVO Public Media. It's brought to you by myself, Catherine Loper, Jason Smith, Leah Landry, and Mark Lavonier. Mark wrote and performed our theme and the music you hear now and throughout the show.
Support for Take Care comes from the Health Foundation for Western and Central New York. I'm Jason Smith.
And I'm Catherine Loper. Thanks for being with us for Take Care.